Hi, today is July 23rd, 2016. This is Mobius Podcast number 167. I'm Todd Ogasawara, and John Westfall is on super secret special assignment somewhere that we can't talk about. But I'm sure he'll talk about it when he comes back. However, I do have some special guests, some old friends. Let's see, shall we do it? We'll do it alphabetically. So Frank McPherson, who was one of the original co-hosts for this show, and also my blogging partner from years back. And Don, let's see if I can get your name right this time, Don, since I've messed it up several times in the past. I've actually spelled it out so I can say Sorsonelli. What did I call you last time?
I
forget. But it was a good one.
Yeah, no, it was good. I was impressed.
Yeah, at least it wasn't Adil Kazim, right? So that was good. Adil Kazim, yeah. Okay, so the first thing, short item I wanted to mention before I get really talking to Don and Frank is Stack Overflow. For those of you geeks who follow that for bits of technical advice and information, they have opened up a documentation beta, which you can find at stackoverflow.com/documentation. And it's really cool. They've got code snippets from every possible programming language you can imagine. Even few you can't. Like, you wouldn't think they'd have SharePoint in there. And yet there's some SharePoint code snippets in there too, which surprised me, since I really didn't consider it a programming language. Next up, for comic book fans, if you have you don't have to have an Android device. If you have a device that runs Google Play Books there and you have comic books in them, there's now a feature called Bubble Zoom, which, interestingly, I couldn't figure out what it meant just by the name, but actually the name says exactly what it does. So when you read a comic book, there are these thought bubbles and speech bubbles of the characters talking, but they're kind of hard to read on a small screen like a phone. So what happens is the bubbles zoom in so that the letters become larger one at a time, so one bubble at a time, which is kind of a neat feature if you're on a smaller device. Even on a larger device like an iPad Pro Junior, as I call it, 9.7-inch device, it's sometimes kind of hard to read comic book thought bubbles and speech bubbles. And finally, for the short items, iOS 9.3.3 was released. And the interesting one about this, there's a lot of security patches, including end-user apps that had vulnerabilities like Calendar, FaceTime, and Safari, you know, things you don't use hardly at all. So you might want to patch it, although I think I read Forbes said that Apple iBooks broke for some people. So you may want to watch out on that one if you're a heavy iBook fan. I am not. I never use iBooks. Okay, so talking to Frank and Don. We'll start with Frank because he bought a new gadget. What did you buy, Frank? And why?
So a couple of weeks ago, I think on a Tuesday, there was the Amazon Prime Day, which is, you know, their billed as kind of the Black Monday alternative during the summer. And last year was the first year they had it. And I remember watching it then and not seeing a lot of sales. But this time around, I basically noticed that the Huawei watch was on sale for about 50% off. So it normally retails for around $400, and I was able to pick it up for a little over $200.
Wow.
Shipping. So given that that was a good price, I pulled the trigger on it. And the reason why, I guess I had a Moto 360, and I think in a prior podcast, maybe almost a year ago at this time, or at least 6 months ago, in a podcast where I more or less convinced you, Todd, to buy your Moto 360.
Absolutely.
That's the one I had. It's an original first generation watch. I basically had two factors of issues with that watch in the end. One is that I was worrying about battery life way too much. Hmm. Bottom line is it wasn't getting through my day, and I was, you know, having to get to the point where I had to turn off like the gesture to tilt your wrist to be able to see, you know, the screen turn on so you could see that. I even shut that off so that I just was pressing the crown in order to see the display, just to try and get as much battery life out of it as possible. And when you get to the point where you're disabling all the features of a device to save battery life, you have to start to ask yourself, why are you even using the device? Because you're not really using it for its intended purpose. So there was that was a big end user issue. And then the other big factor is the fact that Google announced Android Wear 2.0 is coming later this year. And it's been made known that the original Moto 360 will not support that version.
Along with other early generation watches.
Correct. So basically, if you want to continue along with the latest version of Android Wear, you need at least a second generation watch, of which the Huawei Watch is one. In fact, the Huawei Watch is one of two watches that, if you were so inclined, you could get the developer preview of Android Wear 2.0 and put it on this watch. So that was one of the things I checked, because I wanted to be sure that if I bought it, that it would support version 2, and it does. So I have that to look forward to. Overall, I'm really happy with the purchase. I mean, first of all, the battery life is much better than the Moto 360. I keep the display on all the time. With older watches, you may be familiar with what was referred to as ambient mode. I think it's in Moto 360, where it's very dimmed, and, you see maybe a part of the display has been cut down. The second gen phones kind of call it always on, and it's kind of, I think originally Google had developed it to support the always on display that was similar with the Moto X. And it uses an AMOLED screen, so in theory, you know, it does a much better job with battery life. And the bottom line is that is what I'm experiencing. My definition of a battery, my benchmark is that I don't have to worry about it, right? Which means when I put it on in the morning until when I go to bed at night, it's got to be able to run. And, you know, I don't care if I have to charge it each night. I'm fine with that. Some people, you know, obviously used to watches where you could go days, if not weeks, if not months or years. I understand it's electronics, just like my phone. I've got to charge it, but I'm sleeping at night. So if it's charging at night, I'm fine with that. And it does that with no problem. And I'm finding that having it always on display really...
It helps.
It's like a real watch, and you're getting the value, right? I mean, it's the whole point of it. It's glanceable information. Right. So, for example, I use the Outlook watch. I use Outlook as part of my work email on my phone, and there's a watch face for Outlook on Android Wear, and it will show my entire agenda for the day. It will show me my email messages that have popped up. And I can just see, you know, just with sitting here in my chair, my arm on my, armrest, glance down at my watch and see what my upcoming appointments are without having to do anything, right? I don't even have to lift my arm up. It's right there. I think that is, you know, the benefit, one of the benefits of being able to use a second gen watch. So that's been a good thing. I bought the watch came with a mesh watch band, which I was worried about because I have a lot of hair, arm hair. And generally I just wear a leather watch band. And so one of the things I did do was replace it with a band I ordered online at Amazon that cost me $12. The nice thing about this watch is that it has a easy release mechanism on the bands that I designed by Huawei. So you can pretty easily remove bands and put bands on.
Oh, that's good.
And my one tip is if you go out to Google Store for Android Wear, you'll see that they sell a feature, a band called Mode, that has got a self-release mechanism, a nice big button on it. And it looks real easy to use, but the bands cost somewhere around $60 a piece. Huawei provides a similar, not exactly the same, but a similar way. It works just as well. And, of course, then the bands are much cheaper.
Yeah.
Third party. Huawei's bands are pretty darn expensive as well. I mean, their bands run from the $60 for a leather band, and that mesh band that it came with, it cost like $129.
Wow. Well,
so my right tip would be for people to look for third party bands out on Amazon.
Of course, you know, the Apple people are scoffing at you because the Apple Watch band goes up, I think there's one that's $7,000 for just the band. So, you know, they're going $170. Yeah. That's like coffee
money. That's a drop in the bucket.
Yeah. I spend more than that at Starbucks.
By the way, guys, I've got a great Android Wear tip for the older watches. That theater mode, if you leave it on all the time, so there's no screen display, and you get fantastic battery life. The phone, the watch is basically useless, but you get fantastic battery life. My first gen, the battery life was the biggest issue. I love the watch. I love the idea. I like glanceable information, but like you said, when you're obsessing over whether or not you have to charge the watch sometime during the middle to of the day or sometime around there, there's a problem, and that's what finally, at least for the moment, turned me off. There's still a lot of potential, and like Frank mentions, now that you're seeing watches come out, plus supposedly with Android Wear 2, improvements on the battery side, between the new watches, the better battery life, I could see probably going back to it myself.
Yeah. Well, I have to say, I have a first-gen Moto 360, and the only things I turned off on it to preserve battery were I removed Google Fit and the heart rate monitor feature. I turned it off. And I briefly tried using my watch as an authentication device for my phone, my Android phone, but that really killed it, so I turned that off. I didn't have to remove it. But other than that, everything else is on. The tilt, all that kind of stuff I left on. And when I usually put my watch on its charger about 10:30 or so at night, and I've usually got about 50-something percent of battery left, so I'm still pretty happy with my Moto 360 battery life.
Yeah, that's pretty good. I one of the other factors that might have been in play for me is that my Moto 360 was constantly losing connection with my Nexus 6P. I don't know if the problem was with the Bluetooth stack on the 6P or the Bluetooth stack on the watch. There is, if you go out and Google it, there are a lot of people who complain about Moto 360 connectivity to 6P. The Huawei does have support for Bluetooth LE 4.1. The 360 came with 4.0. I don't know if that was upgraded to 4.1. So I don't know if that's a factor. But again, the Huawei watch has maintained connectivity. Now, the 6P is essentially a Huawei phone. So one would think, that they should work well together.
Right.
And that has been the case for me. But I can imagine, in my case, any device with network connectivity, and Bluetooth is kind of a network, that every time you try to go and establish a connection, you're using more power, right? You're charging up the radio to a higher power consumption, so it establishes that contention and in connection, and then comes down. And that's why, if you're constantly hopping between Wi-Fi access points and you leave Wi-Fi on all the time, and it's constantly searching, or cellular is a real big issue with that as well, it can really drain the battery real quick. So that was probably a factor with my watch, in particular with the phone I'm using.
Yeah. I have to say, on my phones, I have not had those problems. These days, it seems to me, at least for modern phones like this, I have a Nexus 6, one generation older than yours, and I have an iPhone 6 Plus, which is, again, a generation behind. The batteries, the radio use of batteries seems to have really been improved over the previous generation. I'll give you an example. So when I was traveling through Scotland earlier this year, I had an iPhone with me, but I didn't have any service on it. I used Google Fi, my Android phone, for voice and data. But I wanted to use my iPhone because it takes much better photos than my Nexus 6, although I had a real camera too. So I left the Wi-Fi on because that's the only way to turn GPS on, it turns out, on an iPhone. So I left the other radios off. So it was in airplane mode, but I turned on Wi-Fi, which automatically turned on the GPS, so I could get location data on my photos. And I worried about it because it was never connecting to Wi-Fi. It was never connecting to anything, really. But I had to have it for GPS. And yet the battery lasted all day. It was really kind of surprising. It wasn't great life. I'd be, when I come back at the end of the day for dinner, it'd be 40% or something. But I had a USB battery charger with me, so it wasn't, too bad. I could charge it up during dinner if we still needed to wander around. So I'm pretty impressed by what batteries have done lately. It might be my Moto 360 is just probably 6 months or a year younger than yours, so my battery may start going south soon. Hopefully not. And I should also note, I forgot to take my watch when I went to London last month. And I was sitting on a plane being really annoyed at myself. But it turned out, You can live without a smartwatch while you're traveling.
So, Todd, do you not do any fitness tracking with your 360 at all? You said you turn off Fit. Do you use Moto Body, or did you just not use it at all?
I use a Fitbit.
Okay.
Yeah.
But see, again, for a lot of people, and for my and myself included, part of the reason why you buy a smartwatch is to do fitness tracking, right? I mean, why wear a smartwatch and a Fitbit when one device should be able to do it? So, you know, back to my point, if you can't use all the features of what the product is intended to use because of battery life, then what's the point of having the product at all? That's the, and I think with a watch, anything that's wearable like that in particular is important because it's a hassle to take the watch off and charge it during the course of the day. And, you know, so if you got to do that, I think for a lot of people, you're going to lose patience.
Oh, absolutely.
And when you factor that with a lot of people questioning the value of having a smartwatch in the first place, it becomes a hard sell.
Yeah, well, I think it is a hard sell. I mean, you know, for the three of us and our other friends like, you know, Sven and John and so forth who have smartwatches like we do, we're basically geeks, right? I mean, there's no getting around that problem. So we are an unusual group. But I think I read that Apple's sales of its watch is down like 50% or something from, you know, year over year. So there, on the other hand, other smartwatch makers like Huawei, they're up slightly. Of course, they have such a small market share, it really doesn't really, you know, make an impact. Apple, I think, has way over half of the market share of smartwatches right now.
I'll be interested to see if the rumors, although they're slightly more than rumors, but if it comes to total fruition, if Google does themselves get into the market and what they offer. You know, there's been the, you know, there's been the rumors, there's been the supposed screenshots, you know, the leaks and everything, but it would be really interesting to see what they potentially come up with. This is turning into a year where we're hearing more and more of Google finally saying we're taking total control. You know, we're hearing the same thing from a phone perspective too, that there's going to be something that is honestly and completely theirs, which would make sense given the Nexus branding, and now hearing that it's not going to be pure Android, you know, with some of the Nexus phones. It'd be interesting to see. I'd love to see what they come out with in a watch, not only from a feature perspective, but from a price perspective as well. It'll be interesting to see if they really try to make an aggressive play to really push wearables on their part.
Yeah, well, I'm not so sure about the price part though, because you know, although in the early days of the Nexus phones, they were very much very aggressive in price. I think I bought my Nexus One for like $250 or something back when phones were, you know, unsubsidized phones were well over $500 or $600. But I think I got a discount on my Google Fi Nexus 6, but it was still like $450.
Yeah.
So, you know, which is cheaper than an iPhone at $600 or $700, but still.
Yeah. It'll be interesting to see what the play is on both of these things, both the phone, from my perspective, from both the phone and from the wearables with the watch perspective. I'm curious to see what the real motivations in this are for them, whether it's just an experiment or whether they do have a deeper meaning in mind. I know from a phone perspective, the 6P and the 5X from an enterprise push perspective hasn't been as big as they had hoped it to be. My question becomes, is this the phone that's totally within their control that potentially becomes their real enterprise play phone? Got to wait and see though. As always, it's with all of this, it's sort of a let's guess, let's have fun and speculate and then figure out when it all gets released how wrong we all were.
Well, the interesting thing about that, Don, is that with those of us who have been with mobile devices for as long as I think all of us have been in our relationship with Microsoft and their efforts over the year, it's always been that contrast between Google's approach and Apple's, Google's approach was similar to Microsoft's in that you make the software, the operating system, and you have hardware partners who make the hardware, and you go down that path. And I remember in the Pocket PC days and the smartphone days with Microsoft, there was always this debate on whether or not you know, Microsoft should have their own device or continue down the path, and the issues and constraints around that. And we saw that they took, you know, eventually acquired Nokia and went, attempted a last ditch Hail Mary effort to do their own device, and by then was too late. Mm-hmm. So it's curious that Google, I think, is found some of the same issues, the same challenges, and having to work with hardware partners and right. getting them all in sync with the releases. Yep. And then the carriers add the complexity on top of that. So you kind of wonder if there is real substance to the rumors that they're actually going to do their own device as opposed to a Nexus device, but something that's just, you know, somebody else manufactures it, but they don't really emphasize that in any real way. It's really a Google hardware.
Yeah.
Whether that happens, how that's viewed and how successful, if they are making it at the right time, and whether it will truly be successful for them.
Yeah, well, you know, although John and I often roll our eyes up when we talk about Microsoft's purchase of Nokia and its subsequent failure, we haven't really talked about the fact that Google bought Motorola, and that essentially was a failure too. So, you know, they've tried to make their own phone through Motorola. That didn't work out real well for whatever reason. I never did figure that out, by the way, because Motorola is a fine company, or was a fine company.
It is amazing to me how many times in the last, now we're almost to 10 years with Google, with this whole mobile thing for them. It's been amazing how many times I have been convinced that their strategy was based upon breaking into somebody's office in Redmond and stealing playbooks from Microsoft for Windows Mobile, because there have been so many parallels. The OEM route, and then the issues with fragmentation. Their foray to, like you said, acquisition to try and bring under control. One thing that's been different for them, because it comes from a totally different perspective, and it's been a fascinating journey there, is their whole perception, and they're trying to work their way into the enterprise with Android for Work, which when you talk to people who are from Google about this, it's new for them. They brought in people who obviously had experience with the enterprise, but you know, unlike Microsoft, where it was business, then we'll throw that aside, go consumer, that didn't work. Okay, now we're starting to see a push back towards business again. For them, this is some new stuff. And it's interesting to see. I'm curious to see how the next year plays out with phone, possibly even with wearables. They're making a very serious play for the enterprise. They're dead serious about wanting to really gain traction there. And in some regards, having worked with both Apple and Microsoft on the enterprise front, I've been surprised at how quickly Google has tried to ramp up. It took Apple, to be honest with you, with iPhone 3, when we still weren't even calling it iOS yet, when they said that was ready for enterprise, it was far from it. And really, iOS 4, when we finally got a branding, started to get there, but it really wasn't until iOS 5. And so all those years. Meanwhile, Google made the commitment, and like in a 1 year period is ramped up incredibly. They still got a lot of work to go to do. Trust me on this. I've been there. But it's going to be fascinating to see where they go with this in the next year.
Well, and the enterprise is a big market and it's stable, right? I mean, one of the main reasons why BlackBerry has probably been able to hang on as long as it's had is because it's primarily targeted at enterprises. You know, there's been announcements of two new Windows phones in the past week, one from Acer and one from HP. And both of those are, you know, featuring Windows Phone 10 Continuum, clearly targeted at the enterprise. I'm sure both companies would be more than happy to sell to consumers as well. But it's interesting that with a market that most people would say is dead, Windows Phone, that you would still have two companies releasing product for it. And so they've got to see that there's still an opportunity in the enterprise segment. And Windows Phone, I think, does, you know, the operating system, the tie to Windows, Exchange, and so forth, is still very much in the sweet spot of enterprises.
Can I tell you, here's an amazing thing to me that I just mentioned a few minutes ago. Microsoft completely for lack of a better term, abandoned with Windows Phone 7, the enterprise perspective of device management, when you think about it. Windows Phone at the time, Windows Mobile at the time, was highly manageable. They abandoned it with Windows Phone 7. We now, with Windows 10, and I'm not going to say Windows 10 Mobile, I'm now going to say Windows 10, Microsoft has suddenly repositioned itself in some ways to be the most manageable platform, not just because of the traditional desktop management, but the fact that Windows 10 across the board can be managed not only by Microsoft's tools, but by third-party enterprise mobile device management tools. AirWatch, Mobile Iron, all these guys, their products not only work with the mobile devices, but now they're working with Windows 10. And it's, you know, when we wonder how Windows 10 mobile devices are actually still coming out, mm-hmm. and you mentioned as from an enterprise perspective, this may be the one place where you see traction for them, is that it's not just an enterprise play because Microsoft traditionally sells to the enterprise. There is a management and a manageability perspective to these devices that makes them highly attractive. Especially with if you're using an EMM platform, as I mentioned, any of the enterprise mobility management platforms, you're suddenly getting everything you might have gotten, and actually it's a lot easier. As somebody who's had to work with SCCM in the past, it's actually easier with the EMM platforms to manage this stuff. Hmm. And that can be the desirability, never mind the continuum, and for a certain audience, maybe continuum does work as the one device for quote-unquote desktop, thanks to docking and continuum, as well as the mobile device.
Yeah, you know,
go ahead.
I was going to say, this is kind of a left-handed compliment, I guess. But the one thing going for a Windows 10 or Windows Phone 10 enterprise play is that the staff that you hand them out to will have no apps to install on it. So they won't be playing Pokemon Go or, you know.
Remember what HP's, what their real push with the Elite is, and that's virtualization.
That you got a point. So you can't play Pokemon Go, but you can't play Angry Birds.
No, you can't. But again, back to the enterprise. I think this is another one I'm going to be fascinated to watch evolve over the next 6 to 12 months for Microsoft, because they finally reached that. Like I said, from an enterprise management, whether it be their own, and you know, I've been mentioning other EMM suites, but EMS, you know, their enterprise mobility suite for Microsoft as well. I mean, they've suddenly positioned themselves to where the days of, you know, when it came to device management, it was as fragmented as operating systems and devices were. Multiple tools to do multiple things. You're now bringing this all under one umbrella, and the, you know, I can manage multiple device platforms, but I've also got a platform in Windows 10 Mobile that is highly manageable and potentially can be used for certain very specific scenarios. Just to let you know, I mean, with all my other daily drivers, I've been downloading and installing on a Lumia 640. I've been installing all the Insiders builds, and if not for the stinking app gap, it's a really nice platform. It's a really nice operating system. And with the anniversary update, it's really smooth. It really is, you know, remember the old fast and fluid. It really is that way. It's just a shame, like you said. It's at this point, it is primarily an enterprise play, because on the consumer side, unless they get a lot of people building universal Windows platform apps, it's a huge gap. And it hits me. That's the reason why I can't use it as a daily driver. There's just apps I can't live without.
Yeah, I know what you mean. And that's why I abandoned Windows Phone years ago. I think, when was the last time you used it? 2012, maybe? Yeah. Yep. So I never saw Windows Phone 8, never saw Windows Phone 10. We'll never see whatever it is.
Yeah.
And I don't miss it because the apps are all on either Android or iPhone, and usually both.
Yeah.
Okay, so next and last set of questions I want to ask, because I'll save this for last because I think it's going to be a long discussion. Is I know that you, Don, recently switched from being an office rat, like most of us, to being a home worker, work at home type of person. I know So that's kind of new for you. Whereas Frank has been doing this for a while now, I think, where you've been working mostly at home, not quite all at home, but mostly at home. So I spent about a year working from home when I was a full-time blogger. And I spent a little bit of time doing kind of part-time home stuff, one day a week stuff. But I haven't done the length that Frank has done. And I'm kind of curious about how new it is for you, Don. So let's start with you, Don. So I think this is kind of a new experience for you.
Yeah, it's interesting because I have, as I've told people over the years, occasionally, for a day here, a day there, obviously, like a lot of people do, you work from home based on situation. But this is the first time in a very long time for me that I am full time. My job is still the same. I haven't switched jobs, but I've gone to being a full time remote worker. And it's funny, having done it in the past. There were certain things, there's two aspects to this. There's a technical aspect and there's a psychological aspect as far as I'm concerned. The technical side, things have just gotten so much easier. I'm actually using a notebook, but with a docking station, I've got two other monitors hooked in. So I've got technically three monitors that I'm working. In some ways, my setup is nicer in my home office than it was at my regular office. And everything nowadays is oriented towards, as long as you have connectivity and reasonable connectivity, you can perform the job. So technology wise hasn't been the big transition for me. It's been more psychological. It's the, how do you make sure that you are as efficient and work as properly as possible now that you're disassociated from interpersonal relationships, interpersonal actions and reactions, seeing people all the time. The big thing for me is, I have a dedicated office space with a door that can close and you don't wander from there. You treat it. This is my office. This is where I have to be. This is where I get my work done. At times in the past when I was doing the occasional, oh, it's a snow day, I'm going to work from home, I might put my notebook on my lap and do work there. And then, I could turn on CNN and watch the TV and do. Right now, my focus is, and I think it's the hardest part, is the technology allows us to do everything just, remotely, just as well, technically, as we were on site. It's preparing yourself emotionally, mentally. I miss the human interaction. Even though I'm such a shy and introverted person, right?
Yeah, yeah, we all know that.
Yeah, yeah. I fear speaking, it's been the tough part. The only challenge I had, believe it or not, was we do a lot of online, similar to Skyping. We use Skype for Business. We also are using some other tools, and just making sure that I had a consistently solid network connection. It wasn't that I had a crummy connection, but it's amazing when you don't have a consistent connection, how much that can ruin a day. I actually went the Wi-Fi extender route just to make sure, doubly sure that I had, because I was sort of at the edge where my office is. It would be good connectivity, but then some days it might be a little bit less. So putting in an extender made a huge difference. Never mind the fact that extender is directly under an Amazon Fire Stick that's up in a bedroom. And wow, that gets a lot better connectivity now. It's an adjustment. I think the biggest thing has been mentally. There's people I was used to seeing every day and I miss them. That's the hardest part, I think. Yeah.
For me, what I ended up doing was I started using Twitter and Facebook as a way of staying in touch with people. And because I did not use Facebook at all until I started working full time at home. And Twitter I was kind of using, but I really started using Twitter and Facebook a lot when I was working at home full time.
Yeah.
Don, so Don, when you for your work, remote work, is your employer actually located within a decent commute of you, or are you like very geographically apart from what would be a normal office?
Well, that's a great question. And actually, the reason why I am now a remote worker was geographically, I was fairly close. although that's all relative in the greater Boston area. It depends on the amount of traffic, the time of the commute. But it was decided financially, the offices that we were maintaining, they decided for the number of employees that were at the office. It originally had been, the space had been acquired with the goal of expansion, and that never panned out. So then they decided that we had a lot of wasted space. And rather than downsize at this point, they just decided to have everybody start to work remotely. So technically, I was geographically very close, and I worked with people on a regular basis. We're all from the area. But now the nearest office to me is our corporate, our world headquarters, which is down in Orange, Connecticut, which is a couple of hour drive. It's worth it for the pizza in New Haven, but not much else.
See, I think one of the interesting things about this discussion is actually the culture that's around it from a corporate standpoint, and there's it kind of ebbs and it flows. Work from home and teleworking became, I think, really popular probably 7 years ago, and a lot of companies, a lot of California-based companies, pushed for it, largely because people's commute in California was, you know, difficult. They wanted to get people off the freeways, save gas, a lot of reasons, real estate costs, and so forth. And so with that came a change in work, right? When I got hired by my original employer, a company that no longer exists today called Electronic Data Systems, and my wife also worked for the same company, I interviewed for the job, and they basically said, you know, offered me the job, said, congratulations, your job is in Detroit, and they moved me to Detroit. My wife interviewed in Denver, Colorado, and they moved her from Colorado to Detroit. That's where the job was. You worked with where the job is located. In today's, you know, age, you could get hired by a company. I could be living here in Detroit, or I could be living in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. My employer could be in California. My work could be with somebody that's in Bermuda or Cayman or in Europe. And, you know, that is perfectly an acceptable or norm. And there's no longer this idea that if you want a job, in a lot of cases, you have to go move to the location. Except a couple years ago, Marissa Meyer became the CEO of Yahoo, and very famously, one of the things that she did is she started saying, okay, she looked out at all the people that worked for Yahoo and realized I've got people all over the United States, if not the world, and they're not in the same building, and she famously started and laid down an edict that says, hey, if you want the job, it's here in California, you got to move here, or you got to move to Yahoo office. And it's interesting that other companies picked up on that same thing, and they started pushing people back together, but the work didn't change. And I would be an example of that. I could go into an office that's actually located. I can, you know, my commute to an office would be about 18 miles, half an hour to 40-minute drive. Not an awful drive or commute by, you know, most definitions of somebody that lives in a major metropolitan area. But if I go and sit in that cube, chances are I'm still working with people via Skype that is in Europe or some other geographical location. And I'm not hardly working with anybody that's physically near me when I'm in that office, because work has changed. How we assemble teams together has changed. You're kind of, you know, it's part of the offshoring, and, you know, half the team could be in India and half the team could be in Eastern Europe. The technology's allowed that, and it's, you know, God, it's good and it's bad. But it's interesting that there are certain companies that don't really realize that the nature of how we assemble teams together and work is drastically different than when I started working in the, you know, early 90s. And this whole work from home now is, you know, very much a common thing, but it's really changed how we do things.
Yeah, I think, Frank, I think it's interesting because you hit upon a really important point to this, a really important aspect. You know, there's obviously business considerations, whether or not it's the most efficient way to do business, to be all in one place or to be geographically dispersed and telecommute. The second aspect of this is completely cultural and sometimes with no business commonality, no business sense. I've worked for organizations where, as a matter of fact, I worked in an organization that was all around mobility, yet from the top down, they felt that everybody should be in the office all the time. This was a mobile company, yet they felt that everybody should be in the same office all the time. And when you asked why, you never really got a good answer. I think it was probably because there still are some concerns from some people that I'm not going to be as productive if I'm working from home as I am if you're watching over me in the office. And I think a lot of that comes down to a matter of, do you trust your workers to be as productive? If you do, then you're comfortable with it. It turns out in my company's case, thanks to a lot of, and I think, I don't know, Frank, if this was the case for you, but my company's history included a lot of mergers and acquisitions. And guess what? They happened all over the country. So over time, some of these were small offices from acquisitions. They shut down offices. They let people work remotely. It's just the way of doing business. Right now, I manage a team, and we've got a couple of people on my team who are in the same geographic location. Most of them are dispersed around the country. They're all part of my team, but they're all based in different parts of the country, and most of them work from home. And the ones that don't work from home full-time are like you, Frank. They work near one of our offices. They go in a couple of days a week, and they work from home a couple of days a week. Culturally, the company has accepted this as a way of doing business. And from a productivity perspective, we've never seen any declines in productivity. In my case, when you mentioned the commute time, huge factor in terms of my overall productivity. I can still get done what I need to get done in the morning, and that's hitting a gym, maybe getting my kids to school, and still start work earlier than I ever did when I was commuting to an office. I also am more willing to work a little bit later after hours because I'm not sitting in a car for 90 minutes stuck in Boston traffic. So it really depends on those two things. Number one, what's your business? What are you truly doing? Can you afford to do this, or is it too detrimental? And number two, culturally, can you trust your employees to be able to be as productive remote as they are in office? If you can reach it, it works fine.
Yeah, you know, from what I've seen, and from my personal experience and kind of talking to people about it, in fact, a while back I had to do a report to folks on telework and telecommuting, which are two different things, of course, but, you know, related. Mm-hmm. And basically, like you said, or both of you said, it comes down to a lot of it is culture and as also you said, it's management. It needs to be a top-down thing with policies in place. Understandable policies, not vague ones that nobody can figure out, and some sort of reasonable metrics, whatever that might be. For some things, piecemeal work, you know, you're writing or something, the metrics are easy. For others, when you're managing people, metrics are a little harder, but the results presumably speak for themselves, whether you're making the sales or getting things fixed or building things, whatever it is you're doing. But it is tough for a lot of people to get wrap their heads around that. And also, it's very tough for people to trust their workers. As you said, that's really the biggest problem is, yeah. You know, are they going to be just, you know, playing Angry Birds all day or roaming around searching for Pokemon or, you know, what is it that they're doing? And I don't know as a manager. That's the feeling that kills telework or telecommuting.
Yeah. Well, you know, and the interesting thing is the also – the other thing that has happened in the last 5 years or so that's part of the startup culture is that the way offices actually work in a lot of these startup companies is drastically different than, you know, even where I am today. If I go into the office, I sit in a cube that has walls that are at least almost 8 feet tall. So it's like you have your own separate office, a more traditional cube. The startup picture, the culture that you see is people who work on, you know, in an open space, no cubes, everybody's sitting at tables. You may be looking, sitting at a table and staring at another person right across from you as they're trying to work. And from my way of thinking, I don't know how you get anything done in that. You know, in some sense, the work from home is a more productive thing because you have a ability to be isolated, quiet, and so forth. In companies, corporations kind of go to, you know, hey, I look at Facebook, I look at Google, they're wildly successful. What do they do? I want to be like them. And then all of a sudden you kind of follow that, you know, approach without much thought behind it. And it's really kind of interesting how things have changed. In a lot of ways, the work from home is kind of more the cubes mm-hmm. of the early 90s than with these open office things, which I frankly have a hearing problem, so I would have a difficult time working in something like that.
Yeah, it's not just a hearing problem, but if you're in an open office space and you need to talk to people, it is a cacophony.
Yeah, that was,
You can't hear what the other person saying on the phone, even if you have a headset on. And they can probably barely hear you because there's so much noise around you. You can't have a confidential conversation if you're talking about, you know, confidential or sensitive information. So, I don't know how that works.
It's either. Telemarketing. Yeah. It's if you ever get a call on your phone for somebody trying to sell you something,
Windows
and if you
support.
Listen, you're going to hear at least three or four people behind you, right? Behind the person talking to you because they're also talking to somebody else on the phone. Right. That's the way corporate America is going to be, I mean, for everything.
It's difficult. Yeah, it's difficult. You mentioned, I mean, before I moved into this space, I had just started doing the management of this team. And I found myself, we had cubicles, and not 8 foot high, but these were reasonably high, but they were still cubicles. Never mind, they weren't separate offices. And I had busy days where I had to be on with having one-on-ones with each of the team members and everything else. I found myself hunting for an office someplace in the building, you know, because we had a mix of, we had some offices and we had some meeting rooms. I was grabbing those because, for just what you said, you can't really focus. It's really difficult. And while you can use great technology for noise canceling as far as what the other person hears, you're still hearing all that noise around you and have all that distraction around you. And that used to make, and I used to be on the phone a lot, whether it be, like I said, now I'm doing it more of it from a manager's position, but previously as doing a heavy amount of tech work, and I'd be on calls with folks, you know, from a, having deeply technical conversations about implementations of software and things like that. And you're trying to focus and concentrate on it. And at times it's really difficult. The open office idea is great if you need highly collaborative work done by a group of people, but it is not a one size fits all solution. And I think that's part of the problem with some of the startups. View it as a trendy thing. I'm going to have an open office and nobody's bothering to say, what are we really doing as a business? What is our business and how are we going to be working?
Well, I wonder though if it's trendy because A, the other companies they say doing it are successful and are doing it. But B, the other companies are successful doing it because they started off with no money and they couldn't afford offices and all they had was an open space, you know?
Right. And you weren't on the phone all the time in those early days of the startup. You're really, during those early incubation periods, you're basically all facing each other and your conversations are amongst each other.
Right.
And in that case, an open space is highly effective as a form of almost forcing communication and collaboration.
Right.
But there's a point where you evolve beyond it. And again, it depends on the business. But, you know, because I heard that up here, we have, you know, tremendous startup community here in Boston. But everybody for a while was like, oh, these are these great new neat office spaces. And I kept on saying the same thing. I was like, well, what is your business going to be doing? And based on what your business is going to be doing, is this the best thing to be, you know, doing? Is this the best way to set yourself up to be successful?
So I think you could sum this up by basically saying that, you know, the emergence of internet access, cable modems, and that type of broadband access is the key enabler for all of this.
Yep.
You know, when I started working from home, probably, you know, dial-up, I still remember doing remote support of Windows servers using a dial-up connection with like Carbon Copy Plus and that type of stuff to get remotes. And you could do it, but you couldn't do it all day. You'd go crazy in trying to. Today, you know, with the internet access, with remote desktop, you can get the servers all over the world. So the technology is there. I think the bottom line is you can't just stereotype and say it works for everybody. I think it's very much a case-by-case basis. You know, some people can work remotely and be very productive. I think other people can't. it depends on your home and your home lifestyle. Do you have kids? Do you have pets? There's a lot of factors that come into play. And then the corporate culture is also very much a factor. And so all that has to come into play in deciding and in supporting somebody that works remotely.
I should say, I should put in a positive word for pets. So if you're working at home and you have pets, I think that's a good thing, not a bad thing, but that's just me.
Well, as long as they're not, John's parakeets during a podcast recording. I agree. And Frank, you bring up a good point. Back to my point of having a dedicated space with a door that you can close. I have two boys. One is in high school. The other one is in middle school. And both of them now, especially during the summer, are conditioned. I will say, based on my teaching them this, that if they look for me and this door is closed, it means I'm on the phone with somebody. I'm trying to perform some sort of work. I will leave. I will open the door a crack if I'm working, but I'm not on the phone with somebody. So they know when I'm in meetings and they know when I'm not in meetings. And as a result, you've got to set those boundaries.
Yeah,
that's absolutely the only way you're going to be. That's the only way you're going to be productive. You're right. You can do it. But there's the factors, never mind the factors with technology, never mind the factors with your business culture, but it's also your own culture, too. Yeah. It's inside your own home what you can do.
So the last observation I'll make before we close out this podcast, you know, talking about cubicles and 8-foot-tall walls and open spaces with no walls. In the old days, one of the interesting things about Microsoft was everybody had an office.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, everybody who was an information worker had an office. That was just with a door. That was just the way it was. It was kind of amazing to walk through Microsoft and see these thousands, literally thousands of little offices, big and small. And they also had meeting spaces. And I remember those Sub-Zero freezers in their lunchrooms and stuff. But Intel, famously, everybody, including CEO, had a cubicle.
Yeah.
And today, Microsoft has changed. I think they're like all, maybe not all cubicles, but lots of cubicles. They're kind of more of a normal company now. And I don't know what to draw from that, because actually after Ballmer left, they did pretty well with whatever office space solution they had. Intel, on the other hand, you know, being a one-trick pony, they're kind of like in deep, deep trouble. Not to say that Microsoft doesn't have problems. I mean, they just let loose thousands of former Nokia employees. But it's interesting that even Microsoft, which had that, you know, office, one office for every person.
I've worked for companies that have switched too. I worked over a decade ago. I worked for a company that started out when I was there. It was, you either had your own office or you shared a very large office at most. And that was, everybody was that way. And just after I had left that company, ironically, it was because I left that they decided to change completely. but they went to the cubicle approach, and left it to certain people, and they chose it strategically on people who needed the privacy of an office for whatever reason. They were always on the phone as a manager or their, things like that. But I don't equate a business's success or failure entirely to any one thing. But I think what we're talking about here today can play a pretty significant part. This whole thing about culture and how your employees work and how they interact together is so I think it's sometimes taken for granted. It's trivialized. Because I've been around people who have worked at places, I've been around organizations that do things a certain way, and their perception of what's the best way may not be. Maybe they do need to be cubicles. Maybe they do need more office space. Maybe, heck, like I said, for some startups, maybe it does need to be an open office. But it's amazing what kind of effect it can have. We sometimes just dismiss it as, it could have some impact. But what it can do for productivity, what it can do for morale, it can matter. It can make a difference.
It does. It really does. And I think you're right. And there's so many variables, right? There's the personalities in the office, good and bad. There's, the office. There's different kinds of open offices. There's whether or not you have some place to meet, when you do need that, either alone time to focus, or you need to shut the door to have a conversation with somebody on the phone or teleconference or whatever that you can't do with a cacophony of noise around you. And the top-down culture, you know, who's the boss and what does the boss think?
Yeah, and, you know, with that whole thing, like you said, it's good employees, bad employees. And speaking as somebody who represents bad employees, no, I think, you know, and as much as, like you said, there's that, there's good interaction, there's bad interactions, there's all kinds of things. The one takeaway from it, and based on what I've seen and experienced so much over the years, is you've got to take all of these things into consideration, and you definitely don't want to, you don't want to, like I said, trivialize or minimize the impact of the type of working situation where, you know, the facilities, the whether it's offices or cubicles or open space or whatever the case may be. You never want to trivialize it, because sincerely, my belief is the moment you do, you're going to get caught. It's going to burn you. Mm-hmm. It's like Murphy's Law, you know. Mm-hmm. So,
okay. Well, that has been Mobile Leads Podcast number 167. I want to thank my good friends Frank and Don for joining me in John's absence. And next up, we're going to record our mythical conspiracy views. We're going to talk about the launch of Skynet, where Facebook recently launched their drones in the sky. And
yeah, no, that's I agree. And by the way, I believe that that the new documentation initiative that you were mentioning earlier on from Stack Overflow,
yeah,
that's actually going to be hiding government information. Just to let you know, I think it's all a big conspiracy.
We got to do conspiracy news.
By the way, as a former technical writer for both education and documentation, I look forward to being able to copy and paste entire sets of documentation as I did from Stack Overflow as a programmer years back. See, now I can do the same thing with documentation.
Yeah, it's great, right? That's
it. Copy and paste.
And, you know, younger programmers don't read books anymore. They only get stuff from the web. That's as far as I can figure, it's true. They look at me when I'm carrying a programming book and go, what are you doing? It's a book.
Honestly.
Honestly,
the first thought I had when they mentioned the documentation initiative for Stack Overflow was, my first thought was, so based on the number of people that cut and paste code over the years out of Stack Overflow, is this now open season for tech writers to grab every piece of documentation they possibly can?
Yep.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. I want to see who publishes the first set of documentation entirely cut and pasted from Stack Overflow.
I'll look forward to your new C# book.
pay no attention to the fact that it was completely screen capped and even got the copyright information on the bottom of the page.
Okay, guys, thank you so much for your time. We will talk again at another podcast.